Hello, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, KBOO.FM on the World Wide Web. My name's Gene Bradley, and today on the Radio Zine, we're going to talk with Jacob Fay about his new book, Dilemmas of Educational Ethics, which he co-edited with Mira Levinson. Jacob, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Gene. So happy to be here.
Great. Now, you're a fifth-year doctoral student at Harvard Graduate School.
That is correct. I actually just finished my fifth year, so I prefer to call myself an advanced doctoral student, so we try to forget the number of years in there at some point.
Yes, I can understand that. You've got to update the website then. your work focuses on the nature of injustice and its relation to school practices and policy. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, my dissertation looks at the inattention to injustice in political philosophy and educational philosophy, and tries to draw out some of the ways in which thinking about injustice rather than, say, justice might help us sort of wrestle with the problems we face in the myriad of educational policies and practices that we are attempting to put in place every day.
So could you tell me a little bit about your background and how you came to this project?
Sure. I was a teacher for 5 years, and I taught middle school history. And eventually, in my own practice, I got so many questions that I realized I needed to spend some time thinking about them. And I decided to come back to grad school. And it's here that I met my advisor, Mira, and I began working with her. And I was a historian, actually, by training originally, and I taught middle school history. But I found that the ethical approach, the using philosophy to try to get at some of the questions that I had, just worked better than anything that I had previously been using to think about the problems and challenges that I faced as a teacher. And so this book and my work as a doctoral student are an attempt to sort of use the philosophical lens that I have been developing over the past 5 years to answer some of the questions that I faced, and hopefully be able to help other teachers like myself to think about the challenges that they face in their practice.
Your co-editor, Mira Levinson, also comes out of classroom experience, I take it.
Yes, she taught, I think, for nearly 10 years in the Atlanta Public Schools and the Boston Public Schools before coming back into academia.
So when you two put this book together, what purpose did you have in mind? Who are you writing for?
So when you pick up the book and you look in the introduction, you'll see that we're writing to a very broad audience, because the basic idea of the book is, one, to show that the ethical dimensions of teacher practice are a real part of teacher practice that we don't talk about enough, and that we should, and that are difficult for teachers to talk about. And so this hopefully can be a way to help them learn how to talk about them, and not just teachers, you know, administrators, policymakers, anybody working around education. At the same time, we're trying to talk to educational philosophers and present a different way of thinking about educational philosophy that doesn't simply look at abstract values and principles, but tries to understand and evaluate the values and principles in context of schools. And then, you know, the book also is an attempt in some ways to talk to social scientist researchers as well and say, hey, look, there's all these people thinking about ethics and thinking about what we should do when it comes to educational policy and practice, and they'd like to work with you and collaborate and think about ways in which this sort of normative side of educational research can blend and collaborate with the empirical side of educational research. So there's a lot of people we're hoping this book appeals to.
Well, as a common reader, an ordinary person who's been interested in public schools in my town, starting with my children's experience, and also that intersection between public education, the purposes of public education, and inequality in America, I found that your work really spoke to me. It really introduced a lot of ways of looking at these issues. And Do you see this getting to the public citizen being useful to somebody who just is concerned with the issues of equity or inequality in America?
Absolutely, Gene. I mean, this is probably just my answer probably stems entirely from the fact that I'm surrounded in my daily life by academics, and that's the first people I think of.
Sure.
But we've been doing this book talk in some of the local bookstores in Cambridge, and we have lots of people of the lay public who come in and are interested in it. And I think even to talk about teachers is to talk about citizens as well. I mean, teachers often, they have children in school, so they don't just see these problems as teachers, but also as parents. And when you read these cases, you'll see that many of them, parents are actually a part of the story. And so thinking about how everyone and anyone should be starting to engage with and think about the ethical issues around schools is certainly fair game. We would love it if our book became a bestseller, but that's probably wishful thinking.
Well, I was going to send it to some school board members I know, just because in terms of public policy, I think it raises a lot of issues and looks at things in ways that would be really helpful in terms of organizing their thoughts on developing public policy.
You know, we have one commentator in the book. I should say, so just to let the audience know, the way the book is set up is that it's actually six case studies, rich case studies that come from actual experiences that Mira or others that we know have had in and around schools. Each of these case studies is followed up by six comments, and each comment is written by a variety of people. There are teachers. We have a state legislator from Massachusetts, former superintendents, social scientists, and philosophers and bloggers. What we're trying to say in the book is that ethical thinking is actually, it's not just the province of philosophers. It requires a lot of different sort of insights that are brought together to truly answer questions about what we should do when it comes to particular challenges in educational policy and practice. So that's sort of a really roundabout way of responding to your comment about the school board, which is to just say that, like, we do have a state legislature from Massachusetts who has been super excited about the book, and she bought it for other legislators.
Mm-hmm.
And she thinks that there's a lot to be said about this as well. So, you know, I entirely agree with you.
In the beginning of the book, you talk about how educators, teachers, principals, policymakers, every day are faced with challenging ethical decisions. These are pretty much made in private. They have to make them on their own with no real framework or, you know, sense of consensus with the community. They have to figure these things out as they come up. And that to me sounds right from talking to teachers about the things they have to deal with every day and trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. And I get a sense your book is trying to enlarge that conversation so more people can see these as ethical issues, ethical choices that people are called upon to make, and establish some kind of conversation about that.
Yeah, it's an attempt to enlarge it and bring it out, right?
Yes, make it visible.
I mean, I only taught for 5 years, so I would say that, you know, I was just starting to really figure out what I was doing when I left, but there were so many times where there was a student that I asked to leave the classroom, or they just made me see red, and I would go home and spend hours beating myself up about, did I respond in the right way? Was I fair? Did I have that student's interest in mind? And did I do the right thing? Did I make the right decision? And it was hard to talk to people about those, to other teachers about those things, because I was worried. I mean, you're worried about, are people going to see me as actually doing something wrong, not just like mistaken, but actually wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when we talk about these ethical dilemmas as being an everyday sort of part of teacher practice, we mean that entirely from our own experience. And we really want to create not just more room to talk about them, but public space to talk about them and ways to talk about them and deliberate on them together as teachers, realizing as well that there's oftentimes not going to be one right answer, but many different principled answers, and that sort of understanding can help us move forward in some of the approaches we have to reforming schools, what we teach in classrooms, how we assess students, the big ticket questions that people in education and parents and citizens really care about.
And as well, the entire big question of how is public education supposed to function in America? What's its purpose? What is it supposed to be concerned with? What is it supposed to address? I mean,
absolutely.
There's almost a separation in this country right now between striving for excellence versus trying to help the most challenged members of our society.
Yes. And the cases and comments in this book, that question, you know, the dilemma between individual good versus social good versus academic excellence versus, you know, being more equitable in educational policy, those sort of balancing acts come up again and again and again in the cases. And, you know, I think one thing that you really do start to see in the way that the many different commentators treat with these questions is that they're not necessarily oppositional things, but they're just competing values that need to be balanced against each other in some way. And so sometimes you might side more towards one rather than the other.
We're talking to Jacob Fay, who is the co-editor, along with Mira Levinson, of the book Dilemmas of Educational Ethics, Cases and Commentaries. Could we look at the first case study of the book and just have you walk us through that to just get a better sense of this? Because I think it's such a great example of the kind of struggles that the teachers and principals face. This is about promotion or retention.
Promotion and retention dilemma. So this is the case that comes almost, it's actually whole cloth, as Mira likes to call it. But it's an experience that she dealt with every year as a teacher in Atlanta and in Boston. And the case centers around a young girl named Ada Artawaris, right? And Ada is an eighth grader who is, her teachers are considering whether or not to promote or retain her. She has clearly not met the standards to be promoted to ninth grade. However, if they hold her back, she will be 16. It's very likely she will drop out from school. This past year, she's missed many days of school, but to be fair, she's been bouncing around in foster homes. Her younger brother, she witnessed, was murdered on Halloween as she was standing relatively nearby in a drive-by. So there's all these hardships. So she's missed school time. She hasn't shown that she's ready to go. She reads at maybe a fifth grade level, but she came into this year reading at a second grade level. So what that indicates is that, you know, when she was at school, she was giving it everything she had, and she was seeking out extra help from teachers. And, you know, one of the teachers notes how much Ada put herself out to get help during the year. And so the teachers are really stuck, should they retain or promote her. And they offer a bunch of different reasons for each, and the case really tries to present the question of what should they do. And we have these six commentators who then offer their advice or try to point out some of the salient and key features that would, you know, tip the case one way or the other.
It's interesting because this is such a real example. The things that might be available options for her, summer school, they're not going to have summer school because of budget constraints. The alternative school that she could go to is pretty much a frightening, dysfunctional place. So the teachers know that, and so that just really narrows their choices so much, and they have, 15 or 20 minutes at the end of the term to make this decision.
Yeah, and that's actually, so one of the really fascinating responses to this case is by an educator here in Boston who writes about how, or one of the problems with this decision is that teachers are making the decision about what to do about Ada with how they think the alternative school functions, not how it is supposed to function. And so his argument is basically, if you sent students like Ada to the alternative school, as it is you are supposed to do, the alternative school might not just be this, you know, holding ground, essentially. It might actually be filled with a bunch of students who are behind, who need help, but have a space where they can get it and are not dropping out. And it's just it's an interesting argument to kind of think about how we make these decisions. Are we making decisions thinking about how things ought to work, how they should work, how they're supposed to work, or how they do work? And if we do it on the basis of how they do, are we just exacerbating problems that we have?
This is a great example of the richness of these commentaries, because this is by Toby Romer, I think.
That is correct.
And his point of view stands out from the others, because the other commentators make strong arguments that it's really a systemic problem, and the way schools are organized, content mastery versus age group progression, all these kind of issues, you know, building good systems that can support children, and in fact understanding how much more complex it is to educate people in such a strange society in terms of equity of distribution. And one of the commentators, Melissa Aguirre, talks about the whole issue of equality versus equity. Could you speak about that a little bit?
Yeah. The best way to think about equality versus equity is that equality is essentially about sameness, and equity thinks about sameness in a different way, right? So you might treat people differently in order to have an equitable effect, right? But in some case, there is an idea of equality in there, because you might just sort of say it's down a level at, you know, the equality of personhood. And because we recognize that people need different things, we are going to provide them with different things so that, you know, different resources, different opportunities, different classrooms, so that they all have a fair and equal shot at, you know, participating in life, in our political and social institutions.
That's interesting, because in Oregon, you know, the state legislature allocates a certain amount per student throughout Oregon. Mm-hmm. But obviously there are people with special needs, there are people from different backgrounds, there are people learning a second language. So it's like, how do you equitably support the individual needs at the same time taking care of the system needs in a fair way?
And I think, so, you know, in some ways, there's a common model is precisely what you just described, right, which is attaching a sum of money to a student. Other districts and schools and states attach, you know, if a student is an English language learner, they have an extra bit of money attached to them. So when they go to a school, they bring not just the state funding, but this extra bit of state funding with them. And so you might think of that as a little bit more like equitable funding rather than just equal funding, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and the notion of various opinions you read in the newspapers or wherever you read things is that there are people, citizens, parents, who feel that if that money wasn't taken out of the pot at the start, that their children would have a richer educational experience. But this money is, quote-unquote, diverted to these special needs people. It's not above and beyond. It's taken out of the total they start with. I mean, that seems to be a big issue in this country, this equality versus equity, recognizing each individual's needs and trying to support those. I think one of your commentators in this, Siegel Ben Porath, talks about it's inhumane and ineffective to pretend that students' lives outside school are irrelevant or expect schools to solve all the problems born of inequality. Yet our public schools are the main vehicle for trying to address those concerns. Do you see that tension throughout your study?
Yeah, that's just a big issue, right? I think anyone in education wrestles with, you know, there's a question about the purpose of schools, right? Should schools be the engine to compensate for the, you know, the massive social inequality that exists in the United States? I think these are the type of questions that we need to be talking about. Like, these are ethical questions, right? These are normative questions about what the purpose of schools should be, what the values and principles are that should guide our policies and practices. And I do not have an answer to that question. All I can say is that I want us to be having more of that type of conversation rather than the sort of quick fix approach that we have adopted.
Yes.
In terms of educational reforms.
Right. Just response to each little specific situation. To me, that's one of the things your book spoke to me about was the lack of any kind of attempt to develop a sense of common purpose. Obviously, these are really convergent demands, but there's no real sense of what the common purpose of public education is. In fact, it's so polarized. I mean, some groups talk about government schools now, which is this contesting of what public education is supposed to be about seems to be a real ongoing and central debate in our country. As a teacher and as a person looking at this, do you see that?
Well, again, I'm not sure if we can hope for a single common vision.
Right.
You know, we try it with curriculum regularly, and it seems to get roundly rejected by people on both the left and the right for different but sometimes overlapping reasons. And again, I don't think it's about finding the common vision, but realizing the plurality of visions that we have for schools and having the public deliberation and talk about that, right? You know, to realize that it's not just about vocational interests. It's not just about, you know, schooling should not just be about being educated to get a job. It's about citizenship. Danielle Allen has written some really fantastic stuff in the Boston Review recently on the importance of civic education. And there's just a very rich literature on the importance of civic education. Mira has written a great book called No Citizen Left Behind that looks at these other purposes for schools. And, you know, I'm skeptical that we can get to a common vision, common purpose.
True.
But a plurality of purposes would be A-okay by me.
I think your book just sort of sets out an agenda to try to think about how do we go about that. One of your commentators, Anders Alonso, talks about even when there's a moral principle like distributive justice on the table, the principle itself is subject to political contestation. And that seems like, you know, even such a strong moral principle as helping our most challenged citizens, there's a balancing that has to go on. And there's, I mean, I think when you talk about teachers and administrators feeling isolated and making these ethical decisions about what's going to happen to an individual, there's not enough conversation in public or among professionals or in the academic community about how do we shape a pluralistic view of this.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of contestation is partly the reason why I got interested in writing about injustice in my own work.
Yes.
And it's really about, and this is part of what the book gets to as well. People use words like justice, like I am for social justice in schools, or I'm for justice, I'm for equality. But we don't really know what that means. And actually, justice can mean a lot of different things for different people. And so you can have very different groups of people with very different agendas and aims laying claim to acting in the name of justice. And so these sort of big abstract ideals are helpful motivators, surely, in moving people to want to reform schools and make the world a better place and make our schools a better place. But there's a lot of disagreement about what they actually are and what justice means and what a more just world would look like or a more just school system would look like. And so, you know, I think Andres's point is well taken that, you know, you can delineate a really wonderful principle that compels 70% of people to believe it, but there's still going to be 30% who probably won't. And so part of what we hope to do is put these principles and views out into the open and have the deliberation and conversations around them that we should be having.
In fact, there's a comment at the end of the book about how the commentaries often disagree more than they agree, and the uncertainty such disagreement reveals is at the heart of the project itself. I think that's really an interesting comment, that people looking at this problem see it in different ways, the system versus the individual and the different needs. What's the reception of the public as you go out to bookstores and things in Cambridge? How do people respond to this?
So we've used this book in our own courses, and when we've brought it out to some of the book talks that we've done, we've had people say, you know, I know this. This was me. I've dealt with this. Usually they're the teachers. We have parents who have read it and have thought or have sort of remarked that they see a side of teaching practice that they didn't see before, and that maybe they'll think differently when they are upset about a decision a teacher made with their child. So we've gotten really positive reviews so far, and I mean that. I don't say that to humble brag or brag or anything. It's just been sort of shocking how people have responded so positively to the book and how interested they've been in what it can offer. And lots of people find, because there's 36 different comments in 6 cases, everybody finds something that works for them, I think.
At the end of your book, you say that it's been your sincere hope that the cases and commentaries find their way into spaces that have an affinity for asking questions. We hope that KBOO Radio and Community Radio is that kind of place where we can ask questions and be stimulated into thinking about these very large issues. So thanks for joining us today and talking about your work.
Thank you so much, Dean. This was a great conversation. I truly enjoyed it.
And our thanks to your co-editor, too. We've been talking to Jacob Fay, who is the co-editor, along with Mira Levinson, of the book Dilemmas of Educational Ethics, Cases and Commentaries. If you're interested in issues like equity and public education and public access, find a copy of this book. It's put out by the Harvard Educational Press, and look at it and chew on it. I find myself going back to it again and again and reading these commentaries again and going back to the cases. So very thought-provoking and really engaging.
And Gene, I would add that if a listener is inclined to do that and they have a story they'd like to share with us, we have a website, www.justiceinschools.org, and there's spaces for you to upload stories of your own, you know, and we actually have a case up there, a new case that Mira just posted about teaching Donald Trump. So that should be particularly interesting for people.
That is so great. Jacob, thank you very much for giving us your time and for writing this and putting this book together. And we just thank you for joining us at KBOO, and we look forward to hearing more about your work.
Thank you so much, Gene.
Okay.
Have a good day.
You take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye.